9, 8, 7. RS-25 engines. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Booster ignition and lift off. The crew of Artemis II now bound for the moon. Humanity's next great voyage begins.
There are roughly 9,000 active satellites orbiting Earth right now, each one doing a specific job, whether that is bouncing your phone signal around the curve of the planet, watching a cyclone form over the Coral Sea, or helping a farmer in Western Australia know exactly which row of crops need water. Most of us interact with space technology dozens of times a day without thinking about it. And now we're sending a rover to the moon. So, what do we actually get back from sending all these gadgets up there? My name is Ray Johnston, and welcome to Download This Show on ABC Radio National. Joining me today to unpack everything space and technology right now, we have Professor Andy Koronius, who is a Chief Executive Officer and Managing Director of the Australasian Space Innovation Institute. Welcome back to Download This Show, Andy.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
And we have Dr. Lauren Fell, who is Outreach and Marketing Specialist at Lunar Outpost Oceana, who is co-leading the ELO2 consortium building Ruva. And she's also a director at Lunaria One, who is putting plants on the moon. Lauren, welcome to Download This Show.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Andy, tell me a little bit about your role. I think when we're looking at the space industry and what jobs are available for people, what it looks like today, what does someone like you actually do day to day?
Yes, pretty much all of the different sectors of the economy are enabled by space. My role as the chief executive officer, I often say it's the chief connector of brilliant people. Huh. I bring together some amazing researchers, scientists, and engineers, and we use space technology to solve real problems here on Earth. We have a number of projects. In fact, we do a lot of work in agriculture, and indeed, at the moment, we are building a national digital infrastructure, which we call the National Digital Twin for Agriculture, that brings together space data, in situ data, airborne data, climate, weather, farm data, and all of those kinds of data are integrated into one national replica, virtual replica of the national agricultural landscapes. And that enables farmers to make better decisions in agriculture, or in miners to actually do far more efficient extraction of resources. We do work in emergency management, bushfire prediction, doing it from space, so many hundred kilometers above Earth. You're able to do it at scale, and using AI, often on board the satellite, you're able to actually detect the fires as early as possible before they spread.
So some really interesting stuff there, Andy. And Lauren, your two roles sound quite different, but very fascinating. Tell me a little bit about the work that you're doing.
So for Ruva, my job is really to bring the exciting things that the engineers and scientists are doing to make Ruva happen into classrooms and into the public, and enable people to get excited, but also feel like they're involved as well.
And what is Ruva? Because some people listening might not know.
So Ruva is a lovely name that was actually voted on by the Australian public for Australia's first lunar rover. So this is going to go up towards the end of the decade, and it's going to drive around on the south pole of the moon and work with NASA to analyze what's in the regolith, which is like the moon dust.
Incredible, incredible. And tell me about the other project that you're working on.
So the other project is called the ALEF project, and that stands for the Australian Lunar Experiment Promoting Horticulture, which is a bit of a mouthful, which is why we shorten it. And this is putting plants on the moon later this year on board a lander. So The important part of this is that it's a technology demonstrator. So there's still a lot that we're learning about how to get something to the moon, how we help it survive. And this is across the Rover project as well as the Aleph project and many others that are looking at the moon to Mars trajectory. It's about sort of demonstrating the environment, that we can produce the environment that will sustain plants and plant growth.
And tell me about Rover. Where is Rover at right now? Have we got any big milestones coming up?
We go through a set of design milestones, and they are, we don't mark our own homework. We have independent reviewers as part of those milestones to sort of look at what we're doing and make sure that we're on the right track. The next one's called a CDR. So that one's coming in the next 12 months. And that is where we get prepared for the really intensive testing campaign to qualify ahead of launch.
I love it. Now, Andy, could you give us an idea of what's actually orbiting Earth right now? And what is it all doing up there?
Yes, absolutely. But before I do, I thought I had a cool job, but I think Lawrence is far more exciting.
Look, I think Lauren's job is going to be hard to beat by anyone, honestly.
Right.
Maybe astronaut is the only title that's cooler than what Lauren does.
absolutely. There are actually thousands and thousands of satellites up in space at various levels, at various orbits. Most people don't realize how essential they are, beyond Google Maps, of course. They are indeed an invisible infrastructure running our lives. So those thousands of satellites are used in so many different areas. Clearly, the GPS navigation and timing system, everyone knows about GPS, finding their location. But they don't know the fact that actually they can't pay for their coffee unless we did have satellites, because they control the precise timing of everything that we do. So any electronic transactions, anything that we use to time, which is just about everything, including the electricity grid, requires precise timing. And that's what some of those satellites do. But of course, we all know about the weather. We take our weather. We all know about the fact that we can watch live something happening in the other side of the world. So there are many, many applications and many satellites, including many fragments of satellites, of course, which may also become a problem.
Absolutely, yeah. Fragments of satellites is something that we've been keeping quite a close eye on recently, haven't we?
Yes, absolutely, and we should be. It's very important, because once something bad happens where there is a conjunction, as they say, or a collision, then that has secondary effects and cascades down to creating more and more junk, which eventually could actually render the whole system unusable, and that would be catastrophic for the world.
Andy, how vulnerable is it? Is it likely that this entire system could be taken down in any easy way?
It is. It is very vulnerable. Very vulnerable not only from natural events, but also quite vulnerable if we as a society do not follow some rules, because already space is now one of those defense-enabled domains. In fact, it is a war-fighting domain now. Most of what is happening around the world in terms of the wars and all of those kinds of troubles are actually using space. And many countries now are getting the capability with high-powered lasers and other technologies to be able to actually render your satellite inoperable. And in fact, now many satellites can approach other satellites and cause damage to those satellites. The good thing about it is that if they create problems often they create a problem for themselves as well. So it's almost like the traffic system where if you do not obey the rules, most likely everyone will be affected, including you. And that's one area that now space has a little bit of protection. And most countries, although it is now an area of competition and contesting space, at the same time, it's also an area of cooperation.
Well, I'm a little bit terrified now, Andy. Thank you.
I'm sorry.
No, I think it's really important for people to understand those vulnerabilities. And you know, we're doing some incredible research and some incredible things in space, but also it's quite a precarious system that we're dealing with there. Australia's role, though, is quite unique in all of this. And Lauren, I'm thinking about Rover working with NASA to, you know, examine what's actually in moon dirt. And I'd love for you to share a little about why that matters and what makes Australia so well placed to contribute to that kind of work.
Yeah, certainly. We know a little bit about some of the composition of regolith, which is that moon dirt, moon dust. And some of it has been brought back to Earth and examined. But just like on Earth, there are different regions that have different compositions of minerals and other things in the dirt. And the South Pole is not very explored at the moment. So it's really a new terrain to examine. And there's things that we think we might find there. So things like oxygen and other things that are essential to a sustainable human presence on the moon. But also, there are going to be things that we don't know we're going to find, which excites me the most. And the importance of this is the scientific discovery, but also the techniques and technologies that we develop in order to discover that scientific data. And those things that we can use moving forward out into the universe further, but also here at home.
I'd love to see the risk chart of contingencies for what you might find in the South Pole. There might be someone sitting there waiting for you. Who knows?
Yeah. That's one of the most common questions we get from kids is, are you going to find aliens? Oh. You can't say no. You can't say never.
So that's we can't say no. We've got Lauren on Download the Show saying we cannot say no to the possibility of aliens on the South Pole of the moon.
And it also depends on what you mean by aliens too. The likelihood of little green people, I'm not sure, but there's lots of different things.
I'm also curious to hear from you what kinds of gadgets and instruments we are sending into space. They must be made to survive some pretty extreme conditions.
Certainly. And so for Rover, there's a lot of things that you might imagine are in any sort of car. You've got wheels, you've got nuts and bolts holding everything together, a battery, because it is electric. And as soon as you take that to the moon, you're in a totally different ball game, because all of the things that we take for granted here on Earth, an atmosphere, a sort of regular transmission of temperature, all of that kind of goes out the window. So take, for example, regolith, which is the lunar dust. It's incredibly abrasive, because without an atmosphere on the moon, with very little atmosphere on the moon, there's no weather, there's no kind of erosion that you get to smooth everything out. So these particles are really, really difficult to work with, and they can get everywhere. And so we have whole teams working on dust mitigation, for instance, to protect it against that. And that's just one of many challenges that we have to design for.
I imagine that kind of technology that you're creating for the moon as well will be applicable on Earth. I'm imagining the dusty deserts of Australia being fitted out Hiluxes with this dust gear to make them
Certainly.
Survive even longer.
Yeah. And things like solar panels, you know, dust on a solar panel reduces the amount of energy it can produce, and things that we design because we have to in space, because there isn't someone to go and clean it off, are definitely going to benefit things here on Earth.
You know, that's something I never even thought about. You know, we've got solar panels on the roof of our house and we can, you know, climb up there and wash them off or hire someone to do it. If you've got solar panels on a rover in space, you're right. There isn't someone up there with a spray bottle and a rag, is there?
No. And if we get bogged, we have to get ourselves out. So all these kind of things that you can imagine are going to be very useful lessons learnt for similar situations here, particularly in Australia where we do have large distances that we have to contend with in many other industries like agriculture and mining.
What problems are you solving for the moon, for these objects, these gadgets, these plants that you're sending to the moon?
So what I love about this area is that, you know, necessity is the mother of invention, right? And there's certain things that just aren't going to be developed unless you need to. And the moon has a lot of need tos. So the moon has such harsh conditions with, you know, temperatures ranging plus 100 degrees to minus 100 degrees Celsius, sometimes in very short distances. As soon as you step out into the sun, it's boiling hot. And as soon as you dip a toe into the shadow, it's freezing cold. You've got the issues of dust and radiation and all these things. And this all comes together in an environment that requires a lot of creativity and a lot of innovation to have anything survive there. So what comes out of that is better ways to optimize the resources, because you don't have the luxury of all the resources and the backups and everything that we have here on Earth when we're sending something up to the moon. And things like power, you know, using things efficiently and sustainably is something that you absolutely have to do when you're in space and away from the protection of Earth. So those sort of things feed back into how we do things better here on Earth as well.
You are listening to Download This Show on ABC Radio National. Ray Johnston here with you. And I am joined by Dr. Lauren Fell, who is Outreach and Marketing Specialist at Lunar Outpost Oceana, who is co-leading the ELO2 consortium building Ruva. She's also a director at Lunaria 1, who is putting plants on the moon. And I'm also joined by Professor Andy Koronius, who is a Chief Executive Officer and Managing Director of the Australasian Space Innovation Institute. I'm curious as to what the Australian space industry actually looks like right now. I think most people are aware that we have a lot of radio astronomy. You know, we've got big telescopes around, that we send some satellites up, but I don't think people have a solid idea of who is in this industry and what they're building. Andy, are you able to provide some context for that?
The Australian space industry is very strong and growing very, very fast. And I believe that the government should be supporting that so that we do not just surrender all of this critical infrastructure to other countries, particularly at times of geopolitical turmoil like now. The Australian space industry, although it's nascent, although it's still emerging and maturing, it is actually a collection of highly motivated and innovative startups, smaller companies. We don't have the luxury of many years of R&D like the United States, China, Europe, and so on. But nonetheless, we are developing a lot of innovative technologies, both for space, and Lauren already gave us some very nice examples, very impactful examples, but also the applications of space for Earth. Because from space, we collect data. We're awash with data. Data by itself is not important. What is important is how do we actually make better decisions with that data. And there is a whole industry, which is still called the space industry, using that data for all sorts of applications in agriculture, in infrastructure, in mining, and many, many other applications. All of the sectors of our economy are enabled by those technologies. Even the computer, for instance, your mobile phone camera, all of those were first developed for space.
Yeah, how much of what looks like exploration and science in space is actually about geopolitics and national security? I'm learning so much from you, Andy.
I think there is quite a lot, Ray. In fact, they say that the best inventions in our history have been either developed for war or they were used the first for war applications. So there is definitely a geopolitical kind of imperative there for us to be able to actually have some control of this, first of all, important infrastructure in our lives. But at the same time, there is a very big economic, geopolitical, but economic imperative, because as you see with AI and the amazing exponential growth of what is happening with the new foundation models and the new AI applications, that is really going to be very much going into space very quickly. Indeed, they are already talking about all of the data that we collect and we store in things called the data centers. They are most likely going to be actually stored in space in the future, because space provides the best environment for them. And therefore, the geopolitics are very intermingled with the economics of space, because at the moment, no one owns space.
That makes perfect sense, because yes, you think about the climate that data centers operate best in. Here on Earth, we require huge amounts of water for cooling, for instance. Space is already cold, Andy. It's already cold out there. Oh my gosh.
Exactly, Ray. And also, data centers require electricity. In fact, the world is running out of electricity, yet I think it was Lauren that mentioned the solar panels before. Actually, manufacturing solar panels in space gives them many times more efficiency in terms of generating electricity than if you manufacture them here on Earth.
Of course.
So it all kind of points to huge opportunities for new industries in space that we haven't even imagined yet, Ray.
We could have huge floating space data centers powered by solar that are just following the sun, so they never get hours of darkness. They're constantly generating electricity. That's what you're saying, right?
Absolutely. And that's not science fiction.
No, it
that
sounds
is already
like it,
fact. That is going to happen in the next couple of years.
Amazing, amazing. Lauren, this is my mind is being blown every time I talk to people that work in the space industry in one way or another. I'm always learning something about our own planet and how we operate and how we can change and do things differently. If Ruva's mission goes exactly to plan, what are we all going to gain from that, Lauren?
We're going to learn about the composition of regolith on the South Pole. That makes us a part of that journey from the moon to Mars and beyond. But the thing that I'm most excited about is we'll be able to see a piece of Australian technology not only sort of touching the surface of the moon, but actually rolling around and exploring it. And that is an amazing thing. There are so many of us that, you know, we're growing up and thought, if I want to work in space, or that's such a cool area to think about space, I would have to travel overseas to do that. And what we're seeing now is kids actually saying, well, this is actually something I can do.
So do we have the talent here to be doing this kind of work? Are we losing people overseas to NASA and ESA? Are we bringing in people from overseas? What does that talent mix look like?
So we have an amazing mix of talent here, and you're right, we are actually bringing people back from overseas who once upon a time sort of had to travel internationally to work in this area, and now they're coming back home to bring their talent here. We're seeing sort of talent pipelines being grown by projects like Ruva and other projects that are driving forward the industry. And the great thing, the thing I love about how that ecosystem is that because it's a growing industry in Australia, there's not a whole lot of people that are sort of space industry native. So you find people coming from vastly different industries into this industry, right? And so with that diversity comes all sorts of new ideas that can sort of cross-fertilize across very different interdisciplinary lines. And space is one of those great chances to be very creative, because there's a lot of unknown unknowns when you head out into space. There's things that you don't know you're going to encounter. And having the adaptability that comes with a diverse, intellectual group or a diverse talent is something that's really going to be needed.
Something that came up when I started reading about Ruva is the concept of space tradies. And, the idea that we are sending people to space at the moment that have plumbing skills, electrical skills. If you're going up to the International Space Station, you need to be able to fix things while you're up there. You can't call someone.
Definitely.
So it feels like the door really is opening to a much broader range of people to be involved in the space industry. But like you were saying, when I was growing up, I thought the only way to do that was to be an absolute genius that was either literally building rockets, being a rocket scientist, or becoming the most elite athlete that has ever athleted, which is an astronaut. So to understand that there's such a variety of roles in between now is really heartening, to know that this is an industry that really is for everyone, just like science is for everyone.
Definitely. And my background's in psychology. I found my way into space from the humanities. And there's certainly a big need, as we're sending humans into space, to have people who are even poets and philosophers being involved.
Andy, what does a thriving Australian space industry look like in 20 years? We've done so much so far. Where are we headed?
The global opportunity of space is huge. It's multi-billions, but there are many competitors, many other countries, and I would hazard to say that we are certainly not the leaders. Even in the small economies, we are not the leaders in as a space industry. So we have a lot to do. I think the government has a role to play in this, because governments are there to build the infrastructure. This is a critical infrastructure, to build the infrastructure and to also catalyze the industry. So with some government support, I think Australia can have a hugely vibrant, no doubt AI-enabled space industry in the next 10 to 20 years.
Oh, here's to that. Thank you both so much for joining us to chat about this. Professor Andy Koronius, thank you. And Dr. Lauren Fell, thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And that's all for this week on Download This Show. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss our future episodes. And thank you so much for all of your thoughts and your feedback. We're very much enjoying receiving them at our email, downloadthisshow@abc.net.au. That's Download This Show, all one word. You can always slide into my DMs on Instagram as well, @RayJohnston, and give us a review and a rating on whatever podcast platform you are using. I'm Ray Johnston, and you've been listening to Download This Show on ABC Radio National.